thanks for arranging these at this unusual time of the year. And thanks all for coming. So I want to start with explaining a bit what my background is. So I am a materials modeler. So what I usually do is I try to develop new algorithms, mostly based on density functional theory, but also other similar approaches to study materials. And we study a wide range of properties, from excitons to high-pressure physics. And we've done some work on topology as well. So I just want to tell you a little bit about two projects that we've done in this area. And hopefully you'll find something interesting in them. So the first one refers to what I call single gap for the context of this talk. And that's probably what you usually understand for topology, like topological insulators and so on. And then in the second part, I'll move on to this multi-gap, which is something a bit newer that we've been exploring. And to start, there are many ways to introduce topological materials like topological insulators. But that will prove actually useful later on in the discussion is a very simple one here, where I look at a material like diamond, showing diamond there at the top left for you. It's usual FCC. Two-atom basis structure, and diamond is an insulator. So I can schematically show its bands. Blue is valence band, red is conduction band, and there is a gap in between. And in reality, diamond is an indirect band gap semiconductor, but we don't really care about that. Here is just conceptually, it has a gap. And then what I imagine here is I pick the carbon atoms in diamond and I pull them apart to the edges of the universe, say. And that's called the atomic limit. And in that atomic limit, clearly the electrons cannot hop from one carbon to another one that's infinitely far away from it. So it's also an insulator. So I also have a band gap here. And in a system like diamond, I can go from one to the other without ever closing this band gap. Okay. Now I want to compare this with another compound, bismuth selenite, which is also an insulator in the crystalline form on the left. And of course, if I pull it apart, it's also an insulator in the atomic limit. But in the case of bismuth selenite, I cannot go from one to the other without closing the band gap. And that's a key difference between diamond and bismuth selenite, and that comes because bismuth selenite is a topological insulator. So we can characterize that mathematically with a topological invariant. Here, I just represent that schematically with changing the colors of the bands to represent what's called usually band inversion at a particular point in the Brillouin zone. And of course, we're one of the interesting things about these topological materials is what happens here in the middle, which is where the topology changes. And for example, that's what happens at the surfaces of topological materials, where you have essentially the boundary between the outside, which is air or vacuum, which is trivial, say, and the inside, which is topological. And this is just a very brief overview that will prove useful later on in understanding some of our results. And what I want to tell you about is, in the first story today, is how can we go from one to the other in say, a real material? And people have done experiments and calculations for a variety of things. So you can imagine tuning some external parameter in your experimental setup. That could be, say, hydrostatic pressure, or it could be strain, or electric field, or something that you're putting in there to modify the band structure of the material to, for example, do or undo a band inversion like this. And the one I want to tell you about in the first story is temperature. So what happens when the driving parameter that can change the topology is temperature. And our study was really motivated by these experiments. So this is an experiment from a few years ago. And what they did in this experiment is they looked at lead selenite in selenite compound. And what I'm showing here is the experimental results they reported. On the horizontal axis, they have the composition of the material. So essentially what they're doing here is they're changing the amount of lead and tin in the material. And then on the vertical axis, they have temperature. And on the pure side, I think that's lead selenite, but I should double check. They have a band insulator. And then as they dope it, it becomes, in this case, a topological crystalline insulator. And as a function of temperature, if it starts as a band insulator, it stays a band insulator. But if it starts as a topological crystalline insulator, it undergoes two changes. The first one is from this sort of pinkish region to the blue region, and the second one is from the blue region to the band insulator.
Is the entire region still well below the band gap?
So we'll get to that actually. So what happens? So let's try to understand this. So the blue to red transition, so across the red line, is relatively easy to understand. So what's going on there is essentially structural phase transition in the system. That's what's shown here. So the high temperature phase in the blue is the one shown here on the left. And that has a particular structure with two mirror planes shown by this vertical and horizontal lines. And those are what protects the topology. These are the symmetries that protect the topology in this particular case. And they lead to the surface states, which are two pairs of Dirac cones. Then what happens as you lower temperature from the blue region is that the system undergoes a structural phase transition across this red line. And one of the mirror planes, that's shown here on the right, and one of the mirror planes stops being a symmetry of the system. There's distortion in the lattice. And that leads to the associated pair of Dirac cones being gapped, and the other one remaining. Is that clear? Okay. So that's what happens across that transition. Now, what happens across the transition across the blue line from the blue region to the white region is that there is no structural phase transition, and yet the two pairs of Dirac points disappear. So that was what motivated us to try to understand a bit more what was going on across that one, which is not it's not a structural phase transition per se.
I guess you didn't comment on the difference between what happens if you dope it with lead or tin. It's just the same.
So I can't quite remember which one is which, but so this would be pure lead selenite or pure tin selenite, and it's just trivial. And then as you dope it, it becomes topological. I should remember which one is the end one, but I don't. I think if you go to the other end, it is topological.
Okay.
So yeah. Okay. Anyway, so this was sort of the motivation for us to try to understand what's going on. Now, from a computational point of view, we couldn't really directly tackle this problem because alloying is really hard to capture in simulations. So we had to go for a simpler problem, and I'll go into that in a moment. But before I do that, I just wanted to give you first. What could cause that, and then a brief overview of the methods we've been using. So essentially, the hypothesis that we had, what we're going to try and do is, similarly to when you apply pressure or strain to a system and you modify the bands in the system through that external parameter, we ask the question, if you change temperature, how does that modify the band as well? That could lead to, say, a band inversion or undoing a band inversion. And there are two main contributions to that. The first one is thermal expansion. When you have a material and you heat it up, its volume changes, and the band structure changes. And the second one is electron-phonon interaction. When you consider both electrons and phonons in the system, they interact with each other, and the bare electron states are renormalized by the electron-phonon interaction. And this renormalization is temperature-dependent. And so that's the second contribution. And our aim essentially was to study these two from first principles, and try and see whether those could cause something like a band inversion. So quick aside on the methods that we use to do that, they're pretty standard, but just to make sure that everyone is on the same page. So essentially, this is the Hamiltonian we're looking at. So we have the electrons in the first term, single particle electrons, phonons, and then electron-phonon interaction. And I'll just very briefly say how we calculate each of these terms in the Hamiltonian. So let's start with the electronic structure. Essentially what we do is we use density functional theory. It's a sort of the workhorse of materials modeling. It's the way in which we use it is in the so-called Kohn-Sham formalism, which is shown there on the top left. So you essentially write the many-body problem in an effective one part as an effective one-particle problem, free electrons moving in this VKS, which is this Conchamp potential. And this Conchamp potential has three terms, the external potential, which is given by the ions in the system, the Hartree potential, and then the last term, which is called the exchange correlation potential, which is everything else that we don't know about. And there is a whole industry in trying to find approximations to this exchange correlation potential. And these approximations work better or worse, depending on the type of material, on the physics of the material, and so on. And here I just, you know, there is a lot of names and acronyms for those. For those experts in the field, they'll know which one to use best for one or the other. In the case of topology, to some extent, it doesn't matter that much which one you use, in that, for example, one of the differences between these various methods is the size of the band gap that they predict. And it's well known, for example, that the local density approximation or GGAs tend to underestimate band gaps. But the beauty about topology is that it doesn't really matter whether you have a band gap of 0.1 or 0.2, as long as, say, you have a topological band gap. For solar cell, it does matter. For a topology, it matters less. As long as you don't have a band inversion, then it's fine. So from that point of view, we can live with various approximations. But anyway, just so you're aware that this is, of course, an approximate theory. For the phonons, what we do is we use the harmonic approximation or the quasi-harmonic approximation to study thermal expansion, where one would essentially minimize the free energy as a function of the volume of the system to estimate its volume at a given temperature. And all it is all the harmonic approximation is you write down the Hamiltonian for the nuclear motion as the kinetic energy and then an expansion about equilibrium, and you truncate that expansion to second order. And this expansion coefficients are called the matrix of force constants. They just measure when you move an atom, how does another atom respond to that. And you can diagonalize that, and you end up with a very simple looking Hamiltonian, which is just the sum over uncoupled simple harmonic oscillators. So standard phonon theory. And then for the electron phonon interaction, here what I'm showing is the first order correction. In fact, you also need the second order correction to properly capture changes in the band structure. But I won't go into that in detail. But essentially what we do is very similar to what we do with the phonons. We just look at the perturbation of the potential when we put in some atomic displacement in the system. And if you do that, you end up with this coupling Hamiltonian, where the key quantity are these matrix elements that essentially describe the scattering of an electron from an initial state to a final state mediated by a phonon in the system. So these three quantities are well known, and it is, you know, you have to use supercomputers to calculate them for a given material, but largely they're the solved problem. And the approximation may be better or worse depending on the material that you investigate. But for our purposes, then we're going to assume that gives a fair description of the sort of materials we're looking at. So we can build this. We can essentially parameterize this Hamiltonian using this method, and then from it calculate what we're interested in.
Do you ever just use a spectral density function for the electron phonon coupling?
So what do you mean specifically?
Like ohmic or super ohmic? Do you even know what I'm talking about?
Not really.
Yeah, it's not important.
Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about it
later. Okay.
It's like GNM nuclear. Yeah. Instead of having that, you just have a function. It's not that important if you know.
Okay.
People use it in like modeling quantum dots and stuff.
Okay. So this is literally the sort of first order scattering term, first order matrix element.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's go to the temperature. So temperature dependence of topological gaps, motivated by that experiment I showed earlier. And rather than looking at that alloy, which is a rather complex thing to model, we decided to go for perhaps the hydrogen atom of topological insulators, which is this bismuth selenide family. So I think this comes from the theory paper. Well, these are theoretical calculations from that paper from quite a few years ago now. So bismuth selenide is a structure I'm showing here. It's a layered structure where you have bismuth and selenium layers. And in the red box, I have five layers which are tightly bound together. And then groups of five layers are only weakly bound each other, so the system is very soft in the C direction, so van der Waals-like. And the family has four members in that structure, bismuth telluride, bismuth selenite, antimony telluride, and antimony selenite. And it turns out that the first three are topological insulators. What is shown here are the sort of surface calculations from that paper where you see the surface Dirac cones, perhaps best seen in the bismuth selenite case. And interestingly, the last one, although it has the same structure, it's actually not a topological insulator. No surface state there. So this is the family of materials we decided to look at. They all have inversion symmetry, and the band inversion happens at the gamma point. So one very easy calculation you can do to show that is to do the calculations without spin orbit coupling, and then slowly turn on spin orbit coupling, and you see how the bands at the gamma point exchange. And that happens exactly at the gamma point because the system has inversion symmetry, so it must happen at the trim. So what we decided to do was to calculate how do the bands at the gamma point change with temperature, and see how that could modify the story of the topology of these compounds. And this is work I did with David Vanderbilt. And the results are quite similar for all materials. So maybe we can focus on the top left, which shows the bismuth telluride results. So let me walk you through it. So the dotted black line at the very top labeled static, that's just the band gap that you get for this compound if you just do a standard EFT calculation. So band gap you get is about 0.7 EV. That's the band gap at the gamma point. Then the orange curve is the change in the band gap due to thermal expansion. So it turns out that for this material, there is experimental data of the structure as a function of temperature. So we actually just took that data. And that's given by the temperature points are given by the orange triangles. And at each of those volumes, we recalculated the band structure. And what you find is that the band gap decreases somewhat from 0.7 to just below 0.6 in the range of 0 to 600 Kelvin. And then the extra contribution we added was this electron phonon coupling contribution. And that's the blue curve. And you see a similar trend. It also decreases as a function of temperature. You may wonder why it doesn't quite agree with the static value at 0 Kelvin. And that's because even at 0 Kelvin, there is a change due to quantum fluctuations compared to standard calculation would just assume that the atoms are stationary. But even at 0 K, you have a quantum fluctuation. So that also can induce what's called a zero-point renormalization. It seems to be quite small in this heavy element, but still there. And then the red curve is just a simple combination of the two. So what we can see in all three topological insulators is that as you increase temperature, the band gap goes down. It never goes to zero, so they stay topological from that point of view up to 600 Kelvin. But it definitely changes by a non-trivial amount, so hundreds of millielectron volts. The final one, which you remember, was the topologically trivial member of the family, behaves in the opposite way. So first of all, I should say we don't have thermal expansion data for this compound because experimentally there isn't. And that's because this compound has a polymorph of a different structure. And experimentally, it's not always easy to get to this precise polymorph. But so that's why we only have for consistency the electron phonon coupling contribution. But you can actually calculate the thermal expansion from first principles, and you actually see in that case that it also goes up. So that one behaves in the opposite way to the other three. And the reason for that essentially is because the band ordering is opposite between antimony selenite and the other three, because the other three are topological. So if you wonder, there's a band inversion, and in bismuth selenite there isn't. So the nature of the states makes them move in the same direction, which in three cases means the band gap closes, and in the other case it means band gap opens. But putting everything together, this seems to suggest that increasing temperature goes against topology. Something that's not topological, it makes its band gap bigger, so it makes it even less topological if you want. It moves it away from the band inversion point. And the ones that are topological, increasing temperature makes them approach the band inversion point to remove the topology if you want. So you can actually do a bit better, and you can try to understand what's actually driving this microscopically. And it turns out to be determined largely by the layered structure of the compound. So in terms of thermal expansion, the system is very soft in the C direction, and it is the changes in the C direction that largely determine how the band gap changes. And that's also why these materials, as a function of pressure, the band gap responds very much, because pressure also changes the C lattice parameter very much. And from the electron phonon coupling point of view, you can also understand which phonon modes couple the most strongly to the electrons. And that's because what I'm showing in these two diagrams is the charge density associated with the electron states at the valence band maximum, and the charge density associated with the electron state at the conduction band minimum. And they're essentially PZ-like or PZ-like states. So the structure is layered, and the states are like PZ-like orbitals perpendicular to the stacking direction. And from this point of view, then, if you do the fully-fledged electron phonon coupling calculations, the phonon modes that move these planes in this way don't couple very strongly to the electrons. And you can almost pictorially see that, because that won't affect the charge density very much. Whereas the phonon modes that correspond to motions of the planes against each other actually couple very strongly to the electrons. And you can sort of think of it as squeezing and stretching this charge density. So that motion really changes how the electrons, really changes the electron cloud in the system. So that's microscopically what's driving those changes. And then the final thing we did was to actually bringing another parameter into the play to actually see a band inversion driven by temperature. So we looked at antimony selenite, which, if you remember, was the material that was not topological. And if we increase temperature, it stayed non-topological at all temperatures. But then if you apply a little bit of pressure, this material undergoes a band inversion, and it does become topological. So you could think of these axes as similar to the composition axes we had earlier in the experiment. And then once we're here, we can also increase temperature, and that's what happens. In this case, the band gap does decrease, and then at some point it goes to zero, and then it opens again, and it has undone the band inversion. So by just tracking those changes, you can then draw this diagram where you have that boundary between a band inverted and the non-band inverted insulator. And this shows that temperature can undo band inversions under the right circumstances. And it may be one way of explaining what's going on in across that line, which is a change in the topology of the system without an associated structural change or anything like that. So ideally, one would like to study something for which is experimental data, but unfortunately, calculations of alloys are very difficult to do. So we're not there yet. But at least it is suggestive that something like this may be going on there. And once we had this result, what we wanted to do was to try to understand a bit more how generic this was, and whether most materials would behave this way or not, and whether there was anything universal to say, or maybe it was all material specific. And to understand that, we need to go back to the two main contributions, which, remember, are thermal expansion and electron phonon coupling. So electron phonon coupling is actually, it's largely material dependent, how that changes band structures. Not entirely, so you can, for example, write down perturbation theory to first and second order, and you can see how the various terms will contribute to that. And you can, for example, distinguish scattering, like intra-band scattering from inter-band scattering and so on. And if you do that analysis, then you will deduce, for example, that for very large band gap materials, for which inter-band scattering will be suppressed because there's a big energy difference between valence and conduction bands, then in those cases, the correction should usually be negative. So you should usually have a band gap closure. But it's not always the case. Symmetry can play a role in that and so on. But anyway, it's a complex thing to study, and it is largely material dependent, what's going on. It depends on where exactly in the Brillouin zone the band edges are and so on. But thermal expansion could be a bit more universal. And the reason for that takes us back to the very first introduction to topological materials. If you think about what thermal expansion is doing, it's essentially pushing the material towards this atomic limit that we discussed at the beginning. So it's essentially separating the atoms from its neighboring atoms. So in a sense, it's taking the first steps towards the atomic limit. So that suggests that thermal expansion will, in general, go against topological band inversions and will drive the system towards normal ordering of the bands. So the question we had was, could we find the opposite, a material where at low temperatures it's trivial, and then as you heat it up, maybe it has a band inversion that makes it become topological. And this suggests that thermal expansion will always work against us, but electron-photon coupling may or may not. But combining both, if one is always against you, then it may be quite hard to find that. So we thought about it for a while, and it turns out that this is not such a big issue, because one, there are materials that actually contract as you heat them up. There are not that many, but there are a few known materials that do that, and that mostly has to do with voids in the structure of the material that allow the atoms to sort of rearrange themselves as they vibrate more and more, rather than pushing against each other. That's what's driving thermal expansion. And second, it could be that the electron-photon interaction is more dominant than thermal expansion. That could also bypass that. So from this, we have since done, tried to sort of do a rational materials design, if you want, trying to see what materials could have something that behaves the opposite to what we've seen so far. And this is one of the ones that we've proposed. So this is a lead dioxide polymorph, well known experimentally, and it's known to be a semiconductor, small band gap semiconductor. What we think is that everything conspires correctly in this material such that as you heat it up, particularly if you apply a little bit of strain to it, then you can actually drive it from a small band gap semiconductor to, in this case, an all-aligned semi-metal in the system. So that would be an example of a case where temperature sort of drives this band ordering that creates a non-trivial topological state. Okay. So any questions up to this point? So there are still many open questions about the role of temperature. So I haven't talked at all about electronic occupation of states, for example, and so on. So these are all very interesting questions that we've been discussing earlier as well. Things like, you know, in principle, you should have mixed states. How do you define topological invariance in that case, and so on? So this is not something we have considered at all yet. All we're looking at here is how does band ordering depend on temperature, which is certainly one contributing factor to what's going on.
Maybe I can ask a question before you get to the multi-gap. So in that 2015 Nature Communications paper, they had observed, they made observations on a certain material, and you did calculations on some other material.
Yeah.
And you said it's too hard to do alloys?
So the material they did the experiment on is an alloy.
And that's too hard to do.
So essentially the way we do the calculations in practice is we use to model materials in DFT, you usually use periodic boundary conditions, plane wave basis codes, and periodic boundary conditions assume that you have periodicity in the system. You have an alloy, in principle, is a disordered system. So yeah, in principle, how do you model that? There are ways you can model that. The simplest one is something called the virtual crystal approximation, where you create fake atoms, if you want, that have an identity in between the two elements that you're trying to alloy together. And then there's the brute force way, which is build a large simulation box, create some amount of disorder in there, and hope that your box is big enough that the periodic images, you know, the length scale of the simulation box is large enough that compared to the correlation length of
the disorder. Is not big enough.
The problem is that the calculation then become, yeah, people have tried, and depending on what you want to study, that's enough. But if on top of that you want to add phonon and electron phonon, then it just becomes computationally unfeasible at present. So
it could be done 10 to 20.
Maybe.
Yeah. Can I just check for the face I grant you mm-hmm. mentioned it goes up to like 600K or something. So what is the size of the zero temperature gap?
Yeah. So it depends on the compound and the pressure as well. So here, for example, at zero temperature, it's 0.3 EV.
Okay.
So 600 Kelvin would be, I guess, 50 MeV. And yeah, even here, after the inversion, the slope is quite steep, so it goes to 0.1 EV. But you can play around. I think it is at 0.8, so it's here, but that's quite close. I'm sure there's something interesting going on here, where we can definitely not, things like electron occupation will play a big role.
Presumably if your effective gap is smaller than temperature.
Exactly. So yeah, in this region, something interesting, much more interesting than what we have here would be going on. Yeah. Good. Okay. So for the second part of the talk, I want to discuss multi-gap topology. And to introduce this idea, I'll do it by comparison to what in this context I will call single-gap topology, which is roughly what I've been discussing so far. And this is work. So we approach this problem from a materials science modeling point of view. The people doing the hardcore theory behind this are these two collaborators of ours, Robert Janislager and Adrian Boehm, both in Cambridge as well. If anything is unclear from the theory side, from my side, it's entirely my fault. They have plenty of very good papers where you can flesh out some of the details if they're unclear from my side. But very roughly speaking, let's first set up the problem. So to understand single-gap topology, essentially what we need is a two-band Hamiltonian. This is the setup I'm going to use. I'm going to use two energy levels, E1 and E2, and E1 will always be smaller than E2. And then I'm going to call the gap in between delta 1. What we mean by single-gap topology is a setup like this, where we divide the spectrum into two parts separated by a gap, or perhaps that gap is crossed by individual like points or lines and so on. We have semi-metals and so on. But in general, a gap and at most a few points or lines joining the bands. And in this formalism, we have topological insulators, we have churn insulators, we have you can add symmetry and anything you want, and stuff we've been discussing so far. So what we're going to do now is we're going to consider this multi-gap topology where we extend, rather than dividing our spectrum into two parts, we divide into more parts. And the simplest model you can write down for that is a three-band Hamiltonian. And specifically, the focus will be on three-band real Hamiltonians. And again, the notation is the same. So we have E1, E2, and E3 bands ordered in like E1 smaller than E2 and so on. And then the gaps in between are going to be called delta 1 and delta 2. And again, we can imagine we have, by gap, we also mean, you know, there could be some touching points or lines in between the bands. And we're also going to insist that this Hamiltonian is real. This can be generally made to be the case when we have C2T or PT symmetries. And in fact, we're going to focus on C2T symmetry in this talk. So in single gap topology, we have how do we characterize things like band crossing points? So one way in which you can characterize a band node is by calculating Schur number. So you can create a enclosing surface around that band node, and you calculate the Schur number on that surface, and that Schur number, for example, would give you the band node charge, and we know, for example, that would be say 1 or minus 1 in the vial semi-metal, and they come in pairs. They can only be annihilated if they meet together and so on, because you cannot change the churn number in a smooth way. In the case of multi-gap topology, it turns out that we can also characterize these potential band nodes, and actually they're associated with the quaternion group. So let's go back to our free band model here. And now I'm sort of bending the third band to create crossing points. So the nodes in the sigma 1 gap, remember it's between the first and second band, so these two, we can characterize them with plus minus I. And the notation I use is filled circles or filled symbols plus and unfilled symbols minus, and then squares for the nodal points in the delta 1 gap, and then similarly circles for the crossing points in the delta 2 gap. And in that case, we can characterize them by plus minus j. If we, for example, consider a pair of nodes in adjacent gaps, then we can characterize the pair with plus minus k, just because ij is equal to k and so on. And similarly, we can look at nodes in the same gap, whether we have plus or minus 1 will tell us the relative stability of these nodes. So if you bring them together, just like vowel points, if you have two vowel points of plus 1, then if you bring them together, you cannot annihilate them. They have to be of opposite charge. And the same happens here. If they have the same charge, then you get minus 1, and that denotes they are stable. You cannot annihilate them together. And something that's interesting about this setup is that the quaternion group is non-abelian. So if you imagine, and now let's make sure we understand this. So at the top, I'm showing a general momentum direction and energy. And here, I'm just showing two momentum directions, and that could be, say, on the C2T invariant plane that we're looking at. And now in this notation, remember, sort of square just means in the first gap, and circle just means in the second gap, and filled or unfilled means positive or negative. So if we loop around one node in one gap around the node in the adjacent gap, because of the non-abelian property of the quaternion group, then we actually swap the charge of the nodes. So by moving around one node around the other, we can then change the relative stability of the nodes in a given gap. The starting point here, for example, these two nodes have opposite charge, they could annihilate. If we then break this one around the node in the adjacent gap, then suddenly they become robust. And remember, this all happens in the bulk.
Could you remind me, what's the meaning of plus I versus minus I?
Yes, so that's the relative charge of the node. So it indicates, just like plus 1 or minus 1 in normal nodes, is relative stability. It just indicates a relative stability. So in fact, in a given node, so there is some gauge freedom in here. So for a given node, the sign is meaningless, but the relative sign between nodes is gauge invariant. So at some point, you have to make a choice as to what you assign to what. But once you've made that choice for one, then you can just build it up as a puzzle, and the relative signs of all of them are gauge invariant. So what really matters is, are they the same or opposite? So in the first case, plus I minus I are opposite. That means you can annihilate them together. They're not stable. And in the second case, they are the same sign, so they become stable. But the actual sign of a given one is not gauge, is gauge dependent, essentially. Okay. And in order to characterize the single gap topology of band nodes, remember we use the churn number. To do it here, we use the Euler class. It's sort of the real counterpart, if you want, of the churn number. I'm sure you'll recognize the shape of these quantities in comparison to things like Berry curvatures and so on. And in principle, just like we can code this up and then do calculations with it from, say, DFT results for the eigenvectors, we can do the same here. So in principle, we can calculate these quantities. Very briefly, what this Patch Euler class tells you is when integrated over the whole Brillouin zone, you get an integer. And what that integer tells you is that the absolute value of it is equal to the number of pairs of stable nodes in a given two-band subspace. But you can also calculate it for a patch rather than for the entire Brillouin zone. And remember, here we have, say, a C2T invariant plane, so it's a two-dimensional thing. And in that case, if you integrate over a patch, it can actually be integer or half integer, depending on how many nodes you have in the patch. And all that means is there are two times the absolute value of that Euler class stable node within the patch. So let's put some pictures into this. So in this particular case, for example, where I have two nodes of opposite charge, if I calculate the Patch Euler class, so my great rectangle just means that's my integration region for calculating this Patch Euler class, then I would get zero, and that is telling me that the nodes have opposite charge, they're not stable. I could easily remove them by just bringing them together. But if I get something, the absolute value is non-zero, then in this case, I would get minus one just because of the signs I have, but that just means there is one pair of stable nodes in that patch that cannot be annihilated as they are.
So is the Berry curvature a special case of the Euler curvature?
From which point of view?
From the point of view of one of them's for a single gap and one of them's for multi-gap, but single gap.
So I mean,
a special case of multi-gap where the other gaps are zero.
There are some relations between them. There are various ways in which you can understand the relation between them. I think I have one here. But yeah, so these are some statements about how to understand them, maybe from a geometrical point of view. So the Berry curvature at the top, you can generally define it on a sort of say a in simple way, a complex two-band Hamiltonian, and the Euler form or the resultant Euler class in a real three-band Hamiltonian, and yes, you can associate these geometrical features to them. So I guess there are various ways to think about them. You could think of them as the real and complex counterparts, or two-band versus three-band counterparts, and so on. But,
yeah. So this 2020 paper, they're introduced. I've heard of the Berry curvature all the time. I've never heard of the Euler curvature.
Well, I think it's not a, as far as I can tell, this is not a new. I think the application to this context is perhaps new.
It's
the application to condensed matter setups, if you want.
Yeah, I've heard people talk about the Euler curvature. Berry curvature, they talk about all the time, right? Like every day. But the Euler curvature is my first time seeing it.
So you can see it does require, you have the EN and EN plus one. So it does depend on at least a pair of bands. As opposed to the Berry to the Berry curvature, which you can define for a single band. Okay, so this is indeed a relatively new development in the study of topological materials in such a way that there are no yet known examples of multi-gap topological materials. So, and that's where we come in. People have actually made some artificial acoustic setups, where they have actually seen this sort of physics predicted here, but no real materials yet have been observed to exhibit this. So, but yeah, as you saw, it's all rather new. So, yeah, we're hoping, and what we're hoping to do here is we're actually proposing a few examples of how we could observe this in real materials and how we could probe it actually. So that's what I want to talk about to finish the talk. We have done a variety of works in this direction. So all of them with Robert, Jan, and Adrian, and then some PhD students, in this case, Siyu Chen. We studied this in an electronic spectrum. This is a known compound, cadmium, rhenium, oxygen. And it's known to undergo a number of structural phase transitions and so on. And what we found is, this is a 3D material which has a number of C2T invariant planes. In fact, it has three. one horizontally and two like that. And what we found is that as it undergoes these structural phase transitions, the crossing point in the material travel long distances within the Brillouin zone, and that's because they can be characterized with this multigap formalism, and they're forced to be on the C2T invariant planes, and because of their charge, they cannot annihilate, so they essentially are forced to travel around. And when they encounter, what happens here is that when they encounter, they travel around the given plane, and then they encounter another node coming in to the other plane, but then if they have the same charge, they cannot annihilate, and they just jump off to a different C2T invariant plane in the system and so on. So this was a nice toy system where we found a known material that may undergo this. The nodal points are within, say, 200 MeV of the Fermi level, so they could probably be accessible with ARP assay and maybe hopefully track them across the structural phase transition. So we do think that there could be some interest in studying these in electronic systems. But what we think may be perhaps easier to do is to not study it in electronic systems. And the reason for that is because electrons obey Fermi Dirac statistics, so you have a Fermi level. And if you have a two-band model, then what we want is a Fermi level in the middle of the two bands. And that's, you know, we know quite a few materials now that have the Fermi levels where you have band crossings, and we know Weyl-Semi metals and so on, and you've seen the Fermi arcs and all that. In this case, because this is at least a three-band model, then the question arises, where do you put the Fermi level? That means that at most you're going to have some nodes nearish the Fermi level, but you're never going to be able to have the Fermi level exactly on both gaps because, well, you have a Fermi level. So from that point of view, electrons could be interesting, and I'm sure eventually there's going to be some ARPES experiment that will see some of these phenomena in fermionic systems. But what we thought is that if we go to a bosonic system, then we don't have that problem anymore because you can access the entire spectrum relatively easily because there's no Fermi Dirac statistics. So from that point of view, phonons, we thought, may provide a more natural platform to study this multi-gap topological physics. And phonons have actually been studied from a single gap topology before. So people have studied similar things to electronic systems in phonon spectra. In general, they're not that interesting, essentially because phonons are not charged. But in this case, we think they may actually provide a more natural platform because of the Bose statistics that they exhibit. So again, this was work with Robert and Adrian and another PhD student, Bo. And what we did was we tried to find a number of materials that could exhibit this. And we went for Kagome-looking materials because essentially we want three bands and Kagome lattice has three sides, so that sort of felt the more natural way to go. And this one here is a silicate, which is, you know, extremely well-known material. We actually went for two-dimensional materials because then in that case, the C2T invariant plane is the entire material, so it's easier in a sense to, you know, you don't have to focus on specific planes in the Brillouin zone. It's just the entire Brillouin zone is your playground. And this here is our calculated phonon spectrum for this material. You have the standard low frequency bands. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but 2D materials have the three acoustic branches that go to zero frequency at the gamma point, but two are linear, like in 3D materials, but one is actually quadratic, and that has to do with the out-of-plane motion, which is different in a 2D material because there's, well, in that third direction, there's nothing else. So this is a well-known feature of phonon dispersions of 2D materials. But then we also find these groups of three bands that we were really looking for that naturally arise in a Kagome-like lattice. And specifically, what we found was the ones we found easier to play with were these three groups of three bands. So we call them group one, group two, and group three, and they all have this typical sort of Kagome-looking sort of shape. We played a little bit around with various parameters. In 2D material, it's very easy to control strain, for example, because essentially it just depends on which substrate you grow them. The 2D material sort of tries to adapt to the substrate on which you grow it, so it's relatively straightforward to apply strain to these materials. So you could think of it as sort of pressure or thermal expansion into the. And we found that quite useful because we can then move the bands relative to each other. Particularly we found that quite useful because by applying some amount of strain, group two and group three became very close together. So that actually provided not a three-band model, but actually, in this case, we'll see the four-band group of bands that together undergo. So you can generalize everything I've discussed in terms of three bands to more bands. And that was also, so in this material, we have the example of three bands and also of four bands, in fact. And then we can also, we essentially want to manipulate this band node somehow. So here we played with the gate voltage, if you want, which is again something relatively straightforward to apply to the material. You just apply a gate voltage across the sample. Essentially, you have an electric field in there, which again is something that you can tune to move the bands around. And it does look a bit messy. You have to sort of sit down and calculate all these Pajoiler classes to build the what we call the global topological configuration, which is gauge invariant, although that means the relative charges and so on. And this is what it looks like. So again, I won't go through this in detail, but these symbols, remember, field and empty just correspond to the sign of the charge. These lines here are Dirac strings, essentially. That correspond to disclination lines between them, essentially. And then what we're doing here is, at the top, I'm showing the sort of a standard phonon dispersion along a particular high symmetry path as a function of frequency. And then here, I'm just showing a projection of the 2D Brillouin zone. And then we're changing, in this case, the gate voltage. And we're seeing how the band structure changes and how these points evolve around them. And it's not easy to see. You have to sit down and see all of them. But essentially, what we're doing, going from here to here, is we're doing one of these, if you want, loops of one node around another to change one node in one gap around the node in another gap to change the charge of those nodes. And crucially, all this physics, actually, because of the crystalline symmetries of the system, that's why you have multiple copies of every point. So not just one here and here, but then sort of symmetry-related copies there. But because of the symmetries of the system, this looping of one band node around another actually entirely collapses to the gamma point in this case. And we'll see in a moment why that's important from an experimental probe point of view. And then we can do the same for the four-band model, which again, very colorful pictures, but essentially, as you change the external gate voltage, you can move these nodes around and make them loop around each other to control these charges in them. And the reason why this material we think is particularly interesting is because this looping that flips the charge and makes them go from stable to unstable all happens at the gamma point. In principle, one could measure experimentally full phonon dispersions, but that requires very large-scale experimental setups, for example, neutron diffraction setup, which is not accessible to most groups. But if things happen at the gamma point like they do here, then all you have to do is you have to look at the Raman spectrum of the system. And Raman is something that almost everyone can do. And it turns out that in this case, this braiding, if you want, just happens at the gamma point. So what we're showing here, these are again calculations, we're showing that all you have to do to see this this multi-gap topology is to track the Raman active modes at the gamma point as a function of electric field in this case. And essentially, you'll see how they come close together and then they swap. And this is essentially the process of the looping of one band node around another one in another gap. We found similar physics in other compounds where this doesn't happen at the gamma point anymore. In this case, it happens around the K point.
Just a question. Yeah. So this swap, the Raman frequency, yeah. Is it clear that you won't get it from more boring mechanism?
So you can, in principle, have bands moving around because of various things. Here we think this is causing that. So I don't have the slides here, but and the reason for that is because we don't fully understand it. But there are other signatures of these things. So there is also a bulk boundary correspondence, for example. that you could, I guess, add as a as an extra feature to complement this this experiment. How the bulk boundary correspondent works in these materials in this type of topology is not yet understood. So when I say we have something, all I mean is that we've actually calculated the surface bands, for example, and we do see that there are surface bands that arise because of the similar to the Fermi arcs that you have in standard biosemi-metal, say. We do see them very clearly in the surface band structure. Oh, we're not, we don't yet fully understand how to properly characterize them. So you're absolutely right. I mean, in principle, it could be various things that cause that, but there are other things that you could bring in into the picture to actually do that. And of course, then you could always do the fully fledged neutron scattering experiment to actually see the full flow on dispersion and actually track all of these changes, not just the ones at the gamma. But that's a good point. But the reason why we emphasize this is because this should be in principle a relatively straightforward experiment. So Raman is used a lot to characterize to the materials and other types of things. So this would be at least a starting point to motivate some experimentalists to actually try this. There are many other things I'm not discussing, surface bands and things like that. We've also looked at other materials that have similar physics and so on. So it is all I wanted to say about multi-gap topology. A bit of ad finish, as Nika was saying at the beginning. I do have a YouTube channel. I co-host a YouTube channel, rather. So we do teach quantum mechanics. So if anyone, it's mostly at the undergraduate level. We do have some more advanced topics, if you want, like second quantization that at least in Cambridge we teach at the sort of final year undergrad / master's level. But yeah, if anyone is looking for resources to use for their students, then we have that. Of course, we started that with the pandemic, but it's been a fun project. So and that's it. So thanks for your attention, for your questions so far.
More questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Ask if this multi-gap topology is preserved under time evolution or not.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
I ask if this multi-gap topology is preserved under time evolution or not.
And
is the result of something of time evolution?
Sorry, you mind repeating that?
Yes. Are you saying whether it depends on time evolution?
Yes, I ask if this topology is preserved under time evolution or not.
Oh, it's dependent on the path evolution or not. I mean, the topology, as in the characterization of the band nodes in any given band structure, then that's just what it is. If you're saying, for example, when we change the charge of one node by making one go around the other, well, that depends on the shape of that path. And no, it just depends on one going around the other, but not specifically on, say, whether that path has a small radius or a large radius. So the other thing I would emphasize is that there is some gauge dependence in here. It's a plus-minus gauge dependent because these are real Hamiltonians. So it's not it's not the same gauge dependent as you would have in a complex Hamiltonian. It's just a plus-minus because it's real eigenvectors and so on. As to the precise frame charge of any given node, but the relative charge of any pair of nodes is not gauge dependent. So the way we explore this is we build what we call the global topological configuration. So you would make a choice for your starting point, say, and then you build it up as a puzzle. Actually, I think I have some slides showing that. So what you would do, for example, is if you have this particular band structure here, and you have a few crossing points, and that's what this tilted squares represent, where we have to assign charges to them. then what we would do is we would go by one by one, and we calculate first the patch Euler class for individual nodes, and we get specific numbers, and then we do it for step from here to here is just using symmetry symmetry related nodes, and then we do that for pairs of nodes, and that allows us to step by step build the global configuration such that the relative charges of any pair of nodes is gauge invariant. You have to make a choice at some point to get started. The relative stability, which is what matters, doesn't matter if you have a different choice at the beginning. You'll get the same relative stability between any pair of nodes. Anyway, that's just showing how you build that practice. I hope, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Any more questions?
So maybe I'll ask one if everyone else is already too shy. So these multi-gap topological systems, which you've predicted theoretically, if people were to experimentally find these, what would be the consequences of that?
So I'm not sure yet. I mean, something interesting is they have this non-abelian.
But the solar cell designers don't care. Oh.
Okay, yeah. No, from that point of view, no. I mean, you could imagine some sort of information type encoding in this. We haven't given too much thought at that yet. We're still trying to understand the. Why I went to this slide. We're still trying to understand the basic properties of these phases, including, for example, the bulk boundary correspondence that we were discussing earlier. That must be there, but. We're still trying to understand.
Consequences in like quantum error correction or anything like that?
So I don't think this could be applied to do quantum computing, essentially. It is suggestive. I mean, these are not boundary states like, say, Majoranes. They are actually bulk crossing points. So from that point of view, it's quite interesting. But I don't think they could be used to build, say, all the quantum gates that one would need. I mean, there's other things one could explore. So here we've just been discussing points. You could also have, just like in complex Hamilton, you have nodal lines, for example, depending on the symmetry of the system. So there is still plenty to explore in this regime that may change this answer somewhat. But I would say at the moment it's all just sort of blue sky driven yet, and just trying to see what we find before we can actually see if there is anything actually useful coming out of it. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
So specifically, you mentioned phonons. Can you do the same thing with photonic crystal as well?
Yeah. In principle, there's no reason why not. I mean, all you have, and at the end of the, I mean, in the case of phonons, your Hamiltonian is just a dynamical matrix. All you need is really a Hamiltonian-like object with the eigenvectors and so on. I mean, here we have the restriction that has to be real,
right.
We have those conditions, C2T or PT symmetries in there. But other than that, yeah, there's no reason why, yeah, you can play the same game that you played for single gap topology and extend this to other quasi-particles. And I mean, electrons, I think, could also be interesting. It's just that phonons seem a bit more natural in this case. But we also have some suggestions for electron systems.
Right. If there's no other question, let's thank Batomi.